Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Today we're going to be in Luke chapter 2 that deals with the feast of the Passover, the last week of Jesus' life. Let's look, if we could. It's going to be a long chapter. I'm going to move rather rapidly. I hope your notes are helpful to you. Now, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which is called the Passover, was drawing near. Well, that's a little unfortunate. The Passover was on the evening of the 14th of Nisan, and in 15 through 21 of Nisan was a seven-day feast of unleavened bread. They were combined together in the Old Testament. I was trying to find that passage for you. It'll be in your notes. I didn't write it down here. Many of us believe that Jesus must have been crucified in A.D. 30 because on that year, when you take the calendar back, the lunar calendar, what it was based on, Thursday was on the 14th of Nisan, and Friday was on the 15th of Nisan, and that seems to fit the schedule with the high holy day of Passover coming in that eight-day feast. Now, notice where it says, so the high priest, the scribes, it's the Sanhedrin, the religious leaders, continued to seek how they might put him to death. Now, they had two major problems. They thought he was a heretic, but they really thought he was going to cause trouble with Rome, and that Rome would come in and put down the revolt and put them out of power, and those are the two major problems they had. Now, notice it says they were afraid of the people. Passover swelled the population of Jerusalem to at least 3 to 5 times its normal number of people, and they were afraid of a riot because many came from Galilee, where Jesus' major focus of ministry was. Now, notice where it says in 3, but Satan entered into Judas. Now, boy, Judas is an enigma. Judas didn't do anything Peter didn't do, really. Even Peter was used by Satan at Caesarea Philippi, the great confession, when Jesus had to say, get thee behind me, Satan, to Peter. But Judas's real problem seems to be caught up in two areas. Number one, he is presented as someone who is a thief. He's always concerned about money, and that seems to fit. You might want to see John 12:6. Matthew 26:14-15. There was a monetary motive. Now, many of us assume that there was a theological motive, that he was trying to force Jesus to act, or he was disappointed that Jesus wasn't more like a nationalistic zealot or something like that. But that is pure supposition. I guess what scares me the most about Judas is Judas knew the Lord, lived with him, saw his deeds, heard his teaching, listened and watched the man minister, knew who he was, and turned away. That is scary to me. It says of Judas that he went to his own place. We're going to have to leave it there. I'll say this. Though God knew and acted on what he knew Judas would do, Judas was never forced. And the one thing the Bible says about Judas, he is responsible for his own acts, as you and I are. Now, Satan entered him, the ideal of possession. You might want to see John 13:27, who is called Iscariot. Now, Iscariot can mean one of two things. It may be a city of Judah called Kerioth. And if it is, Judas is the only Judean in the apostolic group. But the word is very close to the small knife carried inside the robe of the zealots known as the assassins. And so it may be an assassin's knife. And we're not real sure. The etymology is not exact. Who belonged to the circle of the 12. That's the official title for the apostolic group. So he went off and discussed with the high priest and the captains of the temple. This would mean the police of the temple. You might want to see Acts 4:1. How he could betray him to them. And they were delighted to make a bargain to pay him for it. Now we learn from Matthew 26:15, it was 30 pieces of silver, which fulfills the prophecy of Zechariah 11:12. Now they weren't going to try anything during the feast. But here, one of his own men was going to betray him, so they just dropped that approach and said, we'll catch him when we can. Good. Now, notice if you will, and he turned, accepted their offer, and began to seek a favorable opportunity. Now, I think Passover night was a very favorable opportunity. Everybody would have been in their homes with their families. The streets would be deserted. No one would be out. No one would leave. Okay? It was symbolic of the death angel passing over. And the blood on the lintels back in Exodus. So everybody would have been home. There would have been no problem with a riot that night, okay? To betray him to them without exciting an uprising. Now, I want to say a word to you. These events are they differ from gospel to gospel. And it's very hard to put them all together. One of the best attempts that I've ever seen is called The Harmony of the Gospels by A.T. Robertson. I really like him. This is the title page of that book. This will help you get an idea of what's happening in the parallels. Now, another book that I think is really good to kind of put all this together, because it is so hard. This last Passion Week, there's a lot of variety. This is one of my favorite. It's out of print now. I think maybe you can still get it. It's called Christ of the Gospels by Shepherd. Mine's falling apart. I had to put tape on it. But this will really help you get the idea of what Christ was doing. Now, with that in mind, knowing that Luke adds a few things and leaves out a few things, we're just going to go through what Luke has, okay? Verse 7. When the day of unleavened bread came, on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. Now, we learn from Exodus 12:6 and Leviticus 23:5-6 that was the lamb was bought earlier, it was kept, then it was taken to the temple the afternoon of the 14th, ritually slain, the blood kept and put on the altar, and the lamb taken back home. Usually it was 10 adults was the minimum for a Passover lamb. So families went together in a neighborhood, okay? Now, and he sent Peter and John, okay? Only Luke names these, all right? The others don't. Saying to them, go and make preparations for us to eat the Passover meal. And they ask him, where do you wish for us to prepare it? Apparently, the disciples did not know, and Jesus did not want Judas to know ahead of time because he didn't want the interruption in the upper room, okay? Now, and he answered, after you've entered the city, a man with a pitcher of water. Now, most men would carry water, but they would carry it in goat skins. Women usually carried these kind of pitchers. It was an unusual sight. Now, one of two things is possible. Jesus had made preparations beforehand, or he was using supernatural knowledge. Now, there are several events like this, the donkey and where it would be. I don't know if it's supernatural. I certainly believe in a supernatural Christ. But I think this may be a preparation beforehand because of the way that it reads that the men will understand who's asking for it. Notice in verse 14 it says, now the hour came. Now there is a lot of discrepancy between the synoptics and John about when they ate the Passover meal. But there is no discrepancy on the date of the crucifixion. It was Friday. I don't think I'm going to be able to answer in any kind of meaningful way the discussion that's been going on for so many hundreds of years. I think the answer may be in an official and unofficial lunar calendar. But I can't back that up, really, with a whole lot of evidence. It just seems to me that John's using one and the synoptics using another, but they're referring to the same time, and I think it was the Passover meal because of the symbolism of that Passover meal in the Lord's Supper. Okay? They took their place at the table. Remember, they recline on their left elbow, not sit at a table. Their reclining is the normal way. That's how John can lean back on Jesus' breast. He was sitting on that side where he could just lean right back. All right? They begin the supper. And Jesus begins to tell them about his death. Now, one of the things that surprises me about Jesus telling him he's going to suffer is they always start arguing, as we're going to see in this text. Well, I tell you, I shall never again eat one until it finds its fruition in the kingdom of God. Now, kingdom of God is Luke and Mark and John. Matthew is kingdom of heaven. Matthew is written to Jews. It just doesn't use the name of God. It's the exact same phrase. And verse 17, we have an example of the institution of the Lord's Supper. But I want to say to you, Paul's record in 1 Corinthians 11 precedes the writing of the Gospels. And many of us think that Luke has been influenced by Paul's record in 1 Corinthians instead of his regular eyewitness accounts. Now, the reason for that is we've got some textual problems here. And I don't know how to go into this that much. Notice verse 17. Then he received a cup of wine and gave thanks and said, take this and share it among you. And then verse 18 and 19. The problem is there is a longer text and a shorter text of this. There's two major technical problems in this section. I'm just going to go through it with you. If you would like a book on this, I brought one of mine up here. This is on textual criticism. All of us need to know something about it. Introduction to the New Testament Textual Criticism by Greenlee. This is one of several, and I think it'll be helpful to you. I just dropped all the Jewish manuscripts, but anyway. Verse 17 through 20 is missing in some manuscripts. Now, the long text is in the Revised Standard Version. It's in the Jerusalem Bible. It's in my Williams text. It's in King James. But the long text is not in D. Now, D is the manuscript that usually King James is based on, the Bizet family. Usually King James is the one that has many phrases. The other ones don't. But most of the manuscripts have the longer text. The papyri, Alexandrinus, Vaticanus, and Sinaiticus all have the longer text. So it's really surprising that D does not have it. If the longer text is in here, the order of the Lord's Supper is reversed and follows the order of 1 Corinthians 10:16. Now, I must admit to you, I'm not sure which it is. You need to look in your commentary, see what you think. If the whole thing is there, it seems to mention the cup twice. If it's not there, it seems just mention the cup once. And you'll have to decide. Now, notice where it says, he took the loaf. Now, I think he took the loaf first, but the other one has the cup of wine. And he broke it. Now, the breaking of the bread. Now, notice we're not using the lamb. The lamb is a symbol for national Israel. I think Jesus was trying to get away from that. So when he lifted up that bread and gave thanks and broke it, it was a symbol of his broken body. Now, if you know the Passover service, there are several different, four cups of wine, several places where bread is broken and eaten. We're not exactly sure where in the dinner he did this. Maybe he waited till the end. I really think it's toward the end. I think that the cup of wine is the third cup of blessing in the Passover service. So it's down toward the end, and I don't think Jesus ever took the fourth cup of blessing. I think he will when he comes back again. And that's what I think verse 16 is all about. Now, this is my body, verse 19. Roman Catholic transubstantiation says it actually becomes the body and blood when the priest lifts it up and says, this is my body, in Latin. Luther said that the Christ's presence is in, with, and through it, but it's consubstantiated, not quite as strong as literal transubstantiation. Calvin has the spiritual presence of Christ is in, through, and with. Zwingli, more or less a symbol. Now, there are four interpretations. Because Christ is there and speaking, I don't believe it's a metaphor, not a literal fact of us eating and drinking. That comes more from John 6:52 than it does from any of the accounts of the Lord's Supper itself. Do this in remembrance of me as a direct relation to 1 Corinthians 11:24-25, which is the purpose of the Lord's Supper. If we leave this text out with a shorter reading, the reasons are left out. And so that sounds very, very unusual. In like manner, he took the cup of wine, which I think basically the third cup of blessing. This cup of wine is the new covenant to be ratified in my blood. I think it relates to Jeremiah 31:31-34, the new covenant, and also to Zechariah 9:11, which deals with that same concept. The blood here, for a Jew to drink blood would be abhorrent. So it's obvious it's not literal. To drink, the life was in the blood and had to be poured out. The Jews couldn't even eat meat that had blood in it, much less drink a cup of blood. So it's obvious that it was not meant to be taken literal. Yet look, the hand of the man who is betraying me is on the table. Now, depending on what gospel you go to, some gospels have Judas participating through the Lord's Supper. Some have him participating just through the first part of the Lord's Supper, and John has him leading before the Lord's Supper. So here again, we're not exactly certain of which it is. The tragedy here seems to be a going back to Psalms 41:9, okay? For the Son of Man is going away. Son of Man, Daniel 7:13, human and divine. And it has been divinely decreed, perfect passive. It was not an accident. This was God's timetable. But a curse will be on the man who betrays him. And there's Judas's fate. Then they begin to discuss among themselves which one of them was going to do this. And there arose among them a contention over which one of them should rank as greatest. Jesus said, I'm going to die. They're going to say, well, who's going to take his place? Who's going to be number one? You think, surely not. Every time Jesus told them he was going to die, they began to argue over who's greatest. Just watch this. Look at this. Matthew 18:1-5, Matthew 20:24-28, Mark 9:33-37, Mark 10:41-45, Luke 9:46-48. And if you read the Gospel of John, the foot washing in Luke 13 is because they were arguing over who is greatest. My word. It's hard to believe, and yet those men were with him. Don't you know Jesus is going to have compassion on us? Now, it mentions the youngest there in verse 26. Youngest in the sense of doing the most menial task, because the oldest son was the most favored and the youngest was the least. Okay? The servant who waits on him, you just put John 13 there. That's obviously the idea of the foot washing in verse 27. Notice verse 30. So I confer on you the privilege of eating and drinking at my table in my kingdom and of sitting on the thrones and judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, you might want to see Matthew 19:28. 2 Timothy 2:11-12 for that right there. What this ruling is going to mean and what period it is, we're not real certain. It's obvious from other eschatological passages that reigning during the millennium with him is one aspect out of Revelation 20. Look at this. Simon, Satan has asked permission to sift all of you, plural. All the disciples are going to be sifted. They're all going to leave. Simon kind of follows at a distance and gets in trouble. This man had a good heart. He said, "Lord, I'll die for you. I'll go to prison with you." I think he meant it. Boy, he pulled that sword in that garden, was ready to fight every one of those armed men for Jesus. Oh, Peter, but had a good heart. But Jesus knew the weakness of man. And to encourage Peter, after he repented of what he did, he said, "Peter, you're going to fall. And when you turn, feed my sheep." Well, I tell you, I think John 21 is written for the reinstatement of Peter. Notice Satan asked permission. This is much like Job chapter 1 and 2. Satan has to ask what he can do. Hallelujah. He's a dog on a chain, and God holds the chain. Notice it says, after you have turned, you must strengthen your brothers. And there's Peter's trust that he will come back. Notice the cock's going to crow 3 times. Well, there shouldn't have been a rooster in Jerusalem anyway. The Jews wouldn't allow it because they polluted the holy city. Maybe it was a Roman rooster, or maybe they were close to the wall. It was a rooster outside, but there's a rooster in there. It's early in the morning, 4:03 a.m. when this happened. Notice it says, now the man who has a purse must take it in a bag, and the man who does not have a sword must sell his coat and buy one. I think they misunderstood this. I think it's symbolic for they're going to be on their own. Need to be I don't think Jesus was saying, "Now, man, get your gun. We're going to fight." I don't think he was saying that's what Peter understood. They said down here, "We have 2 swords. Jesus, that's enough." Now, when he said 2 swords enough, it's obvious that he wasn't meant that literally. He just meant, "Men, you're going to be on your own. You're going to need to be wise in this thing. You need to be prepared. I sent you out with no preparations. Now I want you to prepare as well as you can for what's ahead of you. I'm going to be leaving you guys. You're going to be somewhat on your own for a while." Now, notice it says he was classed with outlaws. Man, that's direct fulfillment of Isaiah 53:12, don't you think? In verse 38, "Here are 2 swords. And he answered, "It's enough." Now, he's saying 2 swords is enough, meaning it wasn't to be taken literally. Or he's saying, "That's enough of this kind of talk. Let's get on with it." I don't know which it is. Verse 39, "He went out of the city to the Mount of Olives," okay, as was his habit of doing, "and his disciples too followed him there." I really think that he may have camped there every night, or at least had a place he went to pray. Now, the gardens were outside the city because there was no fertilizer allowed in the city. It'd pollute the city. So all the rich people had gardens on the Mount of Olives, officially outside, across the Brook Kidron, out of the official territory of the city itself. Okay, let's see. "That you may not be subject to temptation," you might want to write Matthew 6:13. James says that God does not tempt us. Matthew, the Lord's Prayer prays, "Don't lead us into temptation." I think we are tempted or tested, but with a view toward approval, not for a view toward destruction. Verse 42, "Father, if you are willing, take this cup away from me." And this is, I think, a direct quote from Psalm 75:8, where a cup means a man's destiny. Well, I really get nervous when I get here in Gethsemane, because I see the humanity of Jesus struggling with the will of God in the life of Christ. It's a holy place. I feel so uncomfortable there as my Lord struggles. And yet, oh, I'm so proud of him. He wanted God's will, whatever the cost. He came to lay down his life. But the flesh was weak in Jesus, just like it was weak in Peter, because it's flesh. I wouldn't say it was sinful. It was just weak. And Jesus' deity and will of the Father finally overcomes. Now, verses 43 and 44. Oh, my goodness, what a mess. This is my Greek New Testament, and I'm going to let us insert this critical apparatus so you can see it. This is where the angel comes and ministers to Jesus, and this is where great drops of blood fall from his brow. But ladies and gentlemen, I'm not sure that that's original with Luke. I don't say that lightly, because I have no reason to take those verses out, but I'm not sure they're in the best manuscripts. They are in the one of the manuscript families of Sinaiticus. They are missing in the other manuscript family of Sinaiticus. They are missing in the papyri. They are missing in the corrector of Alexandrinus. They are missing in Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. Those are the 4 major witnesses, and those verses are not there. Now, some say, well, it's independent tradition. I don't want independent tradition. I want what Luke wrote. There is no parallel to this in the other Gospels. I'm going to say to you that based on textual evidence, I don't think it's there. But I feel uncomfortable with that. So I'm going to have to leave it there with you. I hope you'll get that book on textual criticism. I hope you'll ask and see and study for yourself. And you must come to your own conclusion. But I'm going to leave it out of the Gospel of Luke. Notice he woke from there. The disciples were asleep. In Luke, he only comes one time. The other Gospels tell us he prayed three times and came back to the disciples three times. Here, only once. Judas comes with a crowd of men. He kisses Jesus on the cheek. That was the normal greeting for a rabbi. Now, in verse 51, here's where Peter pulls the sword. Now, he wasn't aiming for this guy's ear. He wanted to split this guy's head. It was a high priest's servant. And the guy jumped, and he just whacked off his ear. How would you like to go arrest a man who put a guy's ear back on? We're talking about awestruck. I think I would. The blood, all that, just touched it, and it was back to normal. Woo! Woo! I think I'd left that man alone myself. Verse 51, permit me to go as far as this. Now, that's a strange. It's a present active imperative. Now, if he's speaking to Peter, he's saying, that's enough, guy. I don't want to put any more ears back on because of you. They have to do this. This is fulfilled prophecy. You all calm down. This is what's supposed to happen. Now, if he's speaking to the crowd that's come to arrest him, he's saying, we're not going to fight anymore. Don't worry. We're not going to resist anymore. Now, I don't know who he's speaking to, but it's obviously a very specific statement. Now, it says the high priest was here. I'd be surprised if the high priest himself came. He probably sent some of his family or something like that, and that's what we have here. But I'd be surprised if he came. Notice it says they have swords and clubs. The Romans would have had swords. The temple police would have had clubs. Then in verse 54, Peter's following at a distance, and the slave girls start saying, I recognize you. Now, this is a really different. Some say a slave girl, then a man. There was a group of people that recognized Peter. By sight and by hearing, they recognized his Galilean accent. Look in A.T. Robertson's parallel for this. Peter was ready to die in that garden. I believe that. But that slave girl shook him up. Now, isn't that just like us? The slave girl's question caused him to cuss and deny, but an armed band of 100-plus Romans, he is ready to die on the spot. Isn't that just like us? We fight the big battles and lose every little one we got. Oh, Peter, how I like him. He's the kind of guy, if you can't, don't know what to say, stick both feet in your mouth. That's Peter. I'm going to skip down. The Lord turned and looked at Peter. Now, some of us think that Peter was in the courtyard of Caiaphas. But the Caiaphas had a big house, and his father-in-law, Annas, lived in one wing, and Caiaphas lived in the other. Annas is the power behind the throne. But maybe Jesus was being transported from one trial to the other. Now, these trials seem to go like this. The trial before Annas, the trial before Caiaphas, the meeting of the whole Sanhedrin just before dawn, the meeting with Pilate at dawn. Pilate sends him to Herod. Herod sends him back to Pilate for a sentence. Seems to be the flow of those deals. Now, notice it says in verse 66, they flogged him. Now, the Jewish guards beat him up. The Herod's guards beat him up, and the Romans beat him up. Jesus was beat to a pulp, friends. No wonder he couldn't carry his own cross. 66 verse, it says, as soon as they came, the Sanhedrin tried to meet to give it some kind of legality, but it didn't have any. Look at verse, tell us if you are the Christ. Are you the Messiah? They want a yes or no answer, and they're going to get it. And Jesus is going to say, you'll see the Son of Man sit at the right hand of the God. That's a quote from Psalms 110:1. That's a strong way of saying you're right. And they ask him again, are you the Son of God? They want to know, are you the promised one? Now, the Son of God is used for Israel, Israel's king, and the Messiah. And Jesus says, yes, I am. Now, in Mark 14:62, he says, I am. That's which is a covenant name for God. We know now, from the way they acted, that they knew what he was saying. Now, he said it in a little cryptic way, but he answered their question point blank, I am the Christ, which is the Greek equivalent of the Messiah. And boy, they tore their robes and, you know, cried blasphemy and drug him to Pilate. This is the way Moffat translates this, yes, I am. That is your word, not mine. I would not put it like that, but since you have, I cannot deny it. Well, that's the meaning of it. Okay? Then they said, what more evidence do we need? We have heard it ourselves from his own mouth. Self-incrimination. They tried to get him to hang himself, and Jesus, because he would not tell a lie, did when he asserted, I am the promised one. What a series of events. I wish I knew exactly what happened when, But I know enough to know this. What an awe-inspiring week that was, where treason and fraud and murder and bribery were the common thing, and the dignity of Jesus and His trustworthiness and truth in the midst of all the intrigue happening, that He was the captain of His own destiny. In calmness, He knew it was going to happen and went right through it. When all around Him things were disrupted, there was a sense of great peace, except that night in Gethsemane. I believe the victory was won, not at Calvary, but in Gethsemane. Jesus had tried to win the Jewish leaders by teaching in the temple. He had tried to have time with His disciples to prepare them because He knew they would scatter like sheep. But now the time has come. He stands before the religious authority of Israel and says, "Yes, men, I am the promised one. I am the Christ." And those men who should have known Him from fulfilled prophecy and from the quality of His teaching and from His actions, because of their blindness and hatred, their preconceived notions and prejudice, killed the sinless Lamb of God. But I want you to know, I'm so glad they did, because it purchased our redemption. God bless you.